If you see something, say something. At Reply, weird things come with any weird story you find on the web, and you can help make weirdthings.com even weirder.
Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Mr. Brian Brushwood.
I'm almost on assignment. I was able to sneak this in right before I pass out frozen lemonade.
Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Hi.
Man of many words.
Justin's like, I don't have any frozen lemonade.
There's no, yeah. I can't follow that.
I come bearing an empty pot. I'm sorry, gentlemen.
I'm sorry. I'm a little starstruck here, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, can we jump right in with our big story? The big story is that the Weird Things podcast has been lying to your face for 6 months.
Nothing's weird.
This is all normal. Adjust your expectations accordingly.
Yeah, man, so we can finally say everything, right?
Yeah, everything we can say.
Yeah. Well,
okay, so first of all, when we say on assignment, we may have overplayed the amount of hunting for Monkey Island that Andrew has been doing.
Well, to be fair, the Monkey Island thing was always the listeners. The listeners were the one that I think, like, at some point among Andrew's the last episodes that we did before we went on hiatus, Andrew mentioned the Monkey Island, and he was out there in Los Angeles, and he was going to go look for it. And then we went on hiatus. So everybody just kind of read into the fact that it was Monkey Island.
Yeah. And so, so what we portrayed as an insane grown-up's search for a long forgotten amusement park may in fact be the completion of a full season of magic show episodes for A&E coming this January.
One could say that perhaps. and in fact, our production offices are located where Monkey Island used to be.
That's good enough.
Again,
so I have in fact been living or working at Monkey Island.
Something that was conspicuously not mentioned in the initial Monkey Island conversations was that you were not just randomly going to Monkey Island. You were indeed in pre-production on the pilot and season of this show. It's called Don't Trust Andrew Main. It will debut on the A&E Network this January, the upcoming January 2014. And for those of you who happen to have watched Duck Dynasty's season finale, you saw as the first commercial break, none other than Weird Things' own Andrew Main hawking his new show.
Can I
give ducklings to some lady?
Can I show that to everyone here? Can we listen to the audio on it?
Sure. I can't stop you.
Okay. All right. Well, here, I just typed in now this is what's interesting is I tried to look for it on YouTube, but of course the promo's on Facebook. But like right now, I just typed in Don't Trust Andrew Main, and I'm seeing all these things that aren't your show, and it's gonna be so interesting over the next few months to
have all of that change.
Yeah, exactly. Like right now I typed in Don't Trust Andrew Main and a playlist including videos from BB Live Show are showing up. And it's like we're about to just get stomped by the juggernaut that is the A&E marketing machine. And it's at facebook.com/don't trust Andrew Main, right?
Yeah, I would it would mean a lot to me if everybody listening to this go to facebook.com/don't trust Andrew Main. And if you like the page, you'll get updates on about the show. When new things come out Brian's password, by the way, everybody, is asterisk. You'll get there's going to be new content coming up, more promos, more behind-the-scenes stuff, more stuff about the show. And it is a very, very good way to keep track of it if you go like it on Facebook. Again, facebook.com/don't trust Andrew Main. You can see the first promo there, which I'm excited about.
Let's just take a listen to it right here. I thought this would turn out really well. This was specifically for Duck Dynasty.
And I like to mess with people. Check this out. You a Duck Dynasty fan?
Yeah.
I want you to blow into that duck call.
Okay.
Perfect. They're yours now, so you need to take care of them.
That
Don't
moment.
Trust Andrew May, a new series coming in January on that, A&E.
That extra beat of just leaving them with the awkward holding of it, like I feel like that's a beat we've not seen in magic shows up until this point. And I love that you create that extra moment of weird.
I am very, very excited about the show. I'm very excited about, you know, being on A&E because they're a top-notch network. And offline, Brian, Justin, and I have talked a lot about, you know, our ideas and places to go and things would be, and, you know, and we're of the sort of the same mind of where to take magic into the next level. And I've got a great team of people I'm working with, Mary Jarris, Joe Canbiaggio of Joke Productions. I'll get more into who's been working with me behind the scenes later on. And it's been a great team, but it's exciting. It's one of the things where it's like, you sit around and you go, where would be the nice next place to go? And Brian just zeroed right in on it and goes, there's a neat direction to go into, and that show gets to go there. It's why it's called Don't Trust Andrew Main. It's not magic with Andrew Main. It's Don't Trust Andrew Main.
Well, and
but trust me. You can totally trust me.
Plus, also, and I don't know how much of this you want to get into, you figured out structurally a way to create genuine moments of because when you do a magic series, when you do a David Blaine thing, you physically have to walk around with a bunch of cameras, walk up to someone. And we do this on Scam School all the time. We're like, hey, would you mind being on this show? It's a thing. Don't worry. We're not going to make you look bad. Just X, Y, and Z. There's all this reality. And then they have to sign releases for it. And then, you know, there's other programs that might set up a hidden camera type situation. But really, you have to do that.
I can't talk anything about production.
Okay. All right. Yeah, all right. Regardless, okay, then I won't even bring it up.
No, I know. Yeah, absolutely. But we're as we get more closer to it, we can talk about it's a very different show, in a good way.
I guess that's the thing is that you're doing some things that I had never heard of anyone doing, and you're doing it in an extremely clever way that will make a program unlike any that I've seen of this variety, and I'm really excited about it.
I'm glad, and again, I'm very thankful for your support and Justin's support. It's one of these things where, you know, we work on different projects, we go back and forth and seek out each other's ideas and input on it, and you guys have been super helpful, and I appreciate it. And, you know, it's exciting because it's one of the things where, you know, I am very, very grateful for the community that you guys have grown and that you've allowed me to be a part of, and for the support that's given me and now coming into this. And so I look at it as it's Diamond Club, it's Chat Realm, it's all this expanding into all the different medias. And there are other things in development between the people here, by the way, ladies and gentlemen.
I don't know what you're talking about.
There's things.
If you're referring to my unrelated vacation in Los Angeles, I had a very relaxing time. I really enjoyed hanging out in the desert.
I'm saying that media empires are being built.
Well, I mean, listen, it was an extraordinary couple days when it was one of the last times I was down in Los Angeles. I was able to visit not only the set of Andrew's show that was then in production, and I also visited Brian in a way that I'm keeping deliberately cryptic. It was incredibly fun.
It was a bit of a night attack, Justin. Would that be fair to say?
It was. No, it was indeed a night attack. You know, listen, this show for Andrew, and obviously the closer we get to it, and again, the only way that you are going to be able to, or the way that you're going to be able to find all this stuff the quickest is primarily facebook.com/don'ttrustandrewmain. And just between me, you, and the wall, it does great things for everybody when people follow facebook.com/don'ttrustandrewmain. Well, the primary way that you can demonstrate to everybody who matters that you are excited about
unrelated side story. When I was at Universal Halloween Horror Nights, I was astonished at how much focus they gave essentially three forums. Like even though the sample size is super small and you're looking at basically three super fans of X, Y, and Z, like the suits.
You mean online forums, message boards?
Yes, correct. Like the suits need something to look at in the morning. And yes, they do their general satisfaction surveys and all that stuff. But those guys, like, they can't help it. They look, and whether they mean to or not, they listen and see those comments and those ideas lodge in their mind. So from my personal experience, someone going on one of those forums and just, you know, flatly saying how much they liked X, Y, and Z about my show was extraordinarily significant and meant a lot to the suits. Unrelatedly, I understand that I guess we should go to Facebook.com/ Don't Trust Andrew Maine. Who
it's
knows
a great
who's reading
way
there?
To keep in track of what's going on the show. And
well, again, I mean, listen, it was the promo was first up on Facebook and it's not up on YouTube. I mean, like, if you want to see the stuff, especially we got a lot of people. I know I got a lot of people on Twitter that were really excited when I mentioned, you know, seeing Andrew on TV, but they're cord cutters or, you know, they are going to enjoy this show. You know, in any number of different ways once it's airing, but they couldn't see it. They catch it live on their television. We only talked about it, you know, literally hours before it aired when Andrew got word from the network that it was actually going to happen right then. So, just go ahead. It's going to be the place where you're going to find all the stuff, all the pictures. You can get a good look at it.
There's going to be, you know, it's a, what I love about working with A&E is they really, really get social media. They really get engagement. They're really good about, you know, we've got a lot of cool things planned for coming out, more stuff, content. I'm going to be doing content that's going to be online only stuff about, you know, what we're doing. Can't get too much into that, but there's going to be a lot of stuff there. So you can follow Facebook, iTunes. You know, they're like, they put a lot of their shows are available in iTunes and in other platforms. They have an A&E player, which you can get on iTunes where you can watch recent episodes of stuff. So that's what I'm excited about is that it's neat to be doing a show on a network that's a very big network, but gets online better than other places and makes it very accessible to my audience and our audience that likes to watch the stuff in many different ways.
So can we speak in general terms? I mean, since this is the Weird Things podcast and you have undergone, I think what we all agree is a very weird thing, which is the pitching, the successful production, and now are seeing the launch of it without and I
overnight
know that,
success.
Well, okay. Yes. From 0 to 900 likes and counting. Can you speak to what happens in the intimate space in your head as all this happens? Like, is there part of you that's detached and kind of watching this, kind of marveling?
It's still very surreal. And you know, when you get involved in television, you get very first, you know, the first time somebody says who has the power to make a show happen, who wants to hear you, is exciting. And the first time that happens, it's that, wow, you're getting that chance. And then there are these different stages. Then each stage, then you realize there's another stage. And I've been pitching shows for
as long as I've known you.
Yeah. And the reason Justin and I work together was so Justin could run part of what the part of what I was doing while I would go out to LA and go pitch shows. I did a pilot 7 years ago, you know, that I actually had Justin on, and that's, you know, one of the first times we worked together in that way. And it's been a long, long, long process. And then I did a Cartoon Network pilot. And so this was the third pilot I did. And along the way, I said I wanted to become a producer. And that's how I was able to work on stuff like G4 Underground and do some other projects. But you get used to a certain level of, okay, you're always in development. You're always here and there. And then, you know, I did the pilot with Joaquin Biagio and Mary. And that was a great experience. But then it's like, okay, I've done pilots before. Now it's inevitable. No, they're not going to go to series. And then when you get that call, we're going to series. And they did a very big episode order, by the way. So that was really exciting, was that.
So I would imagine you get the twin flashes of adrenaline of one of the Ron Paul animated GIF of it's happening. And then the deep sucker punch of realizing what a massive body of work you're about to have to produce and come up with.
But I just, you know, you hear people go, oh, worked with a great crew of people. Great. I had a really great group of people who I knew before, and then people who we brought on who had worked with other parts of it and whatever. And so that it was, I had an absolute blast doing it. I think you'll see that in the show, but you get these surreal moments. And I think that when, you know, having had this secret for so long and waiting for an announcement or something so I could tell people what I was doing, you know, you're kind of like waiting. And then finally, when the Facebook page went live and there's no press release yet either. You know, we're going to be releasing information about this show a little bit at a time. when that press release went out, and I could finally tell people what I was doing.
So, who has been, and also
just real quick to go back to, you know, the production stuff. That's the reason for the hiatus. For everybody who's like, well, you know, like you were away for a while. We didn't want to do the show without Andrew because, I mean, like here and there, it can kind of work, but stretch a bunch of episodes together. It's kind of the balance, the bouncing between the three of us. And since this was such a huge undertaking, you wanted to clear the decks and just focus on exactly what it was, since you had never been through that experience.
Yeah, I'm not a multitasker. I have to focus specifically on stuff. And you'll notice that there'll sometimes be hiatuses when I'm working on a book, you know, and I have to just straight on forward through. But I can be extremely productive in a short amount of time, but I can't do anything else during that time. And, you know, for this, I just needed to I'm very much, when I give 100% to something, I want to give 100% and do that. But that being said, is that I'm excited about getting back into Weird Things. I'm excited about just doing this on a regular. And mind you, I wanted to do this episode sooner this week, but these two guys were busy. So
true, fair point.
So I look forward to doing this. And also, like, you know, should the show continue, whatever, you know, we'll figure out a way to make this stuff happen on a regular basis. It's just trying to figure out, you know, I found a pretty good balance. So
all right, now I know we got Weird Things to move into, but like, seriously, who's been the most surprising person to come out of the woodwork so far? Because it's only, I would imagine, people you haven't spoken to in a long time are suddenly going to reach out to you and be all like, what the heck? I'm sitting there and all of a sudden Andrew Maine's on my TV.
Well,
like,
I'll tell you, I'll give Andrew a second to come up with something. The first time I met Andrew, Andrew was doing a after school critical thinking class at the high school that we both attended. And he had graduated from while I was a student. And on Facebook, there was just a natural gathering of all the kids that, I mean, are now, you know, we're now in our late 20s, early 30s. Some, many are married and have kids and everything, that just, you know, all of a sudden just sort of grouped up on Facebook, sharing a picture of Andrew, you know, that first Don't Trust Andrew Maine on A&E logo. And it was an amazing thing to just even see those people and see what they become and you know, kind of see where life had taken Andrew, that, you know, we all had met oh so many years ago and is now, you know, a bona fide television star.
That's amazing. Well,
I've only had one promo run, so
we're acting like a
bar,
it was
Andrew.
It was a great ride. I hope you enjoyed it, Andrew.
a lot can happen between now and when the show runs. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've been, you know, I'll tell you what was kind of encouraging too, is that like the number of people who are crew and worked on the show on Facebook, cause you work on shows or you see shows sometimes that come out there and they don't get a lot of support from people who worked on the show, and just a tremendous amount of support from people who worked on the show. And, you know, that promo shot we did was separate from the actual, the regular body of shooting. And, you know, I was doing some pickup shots and ran into somebody who had worked on that and just stopped in the parking lot and was excited to say hi. And that was cool to know that the people who worked on it had a lot of fun and are excited about the show. That's what's really cool, is to see that kind of, that part of it, is to know that it's, you know, that they feel invested and had fun with it and felt like we were doing something special.
Yeah.
Can we say, we can't say who shot the promo, can we?
I don't think we can say yet.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't have an answer to that.
But it's awesome.
We were. It was great. Yeah,
we could say it's a friendly, right?
We have a lot of time to talk about.
Okay, you're right.
Time to talk about. Facebook.com/Don't Trust Andrew Maine. I mean, sincerely, please, if you can go on there and like it, it would really, really mean a lot to me.
Moment in that promo that you can see again on Facebook.com/Don't Trust Andrew Maine. like right now for constant updates. There's a moment in that promo after Andrew hands the box of ducklings to the girl and walks away where it's just this face of, I just made some magic. It's Andrew's. I just magic.
You just got magic, lady.
Place, right? Face. And it's a face that I've seen countless times in teasers and DVDs and stuff like, and I've seen that face in a sweaty warehouse, a 100-degree warehouse, because we have to turn off all the ACs so we don't get any, you know, sound on the mics and stuff like that. And it was like, look, there's the face up in lights the way it should be. That's for whatever reason, that was the moment that just kind of touched home to me.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So that's cool. So, thank you guys for the nice big push for the show. I appreciate it. And, here's to
don't mistake this being Justin and I are behind you, right? And you think
don't
it's
mistake our kindness for weakness,
right? No, we're behind you, and you perceive us as pushing you forward, but we have to be behind you so we could ride your coattails. I mean, it's
a circular thing. I mean, we're grabbing each other's. You know, I have no illusions as to where a large support of the things like my books and all that came from. And, you know, I think we will continue to ride each other's coattails.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right in public. And you can watch it all, man. I'm ready to get weird.
Circle of coattail.
I feel like I'm all warmed up now that we talked about something kind of weird.
I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, the guy to get J.J. Abrams Hardys, you know, are now writing Transformers movies. You know,
is that real?
Every success begets success. It's a great time.
Well, let's get successfully weird right now.
All right. You want weird? You want really weird?
Mm-hmm.
Let's get weird.
How about the Yeti? You like the Yeti?
Yeah.
Love it.
Big Yetis fans?
They used to call me Yeti Baguette back in Koreatown.
I'm going to put
That's right. In fact, it was a business venture Justin and I had. It was a theme restaurant called Yeti Baguette and his crazy spaghetti. And you would go there. Ironically, now this was maybe too meta, we didn't actually serve spaghetti. We just thought it'd be hilarious to name a restaurant Yeti Baguette spaghetti.
We didn't serve it after the first night where trying to tie in the Yeti and the spaghetti. The spaghetti, quote unquote, was really just hair. It was white hair that we gave
Ironically, the customers loved it, but it turns out FDA, not a big fan of selling hair and calling it spaghetti.
Mm. Also, it turns out that the customers were horses, and they'll literally eat anything.
Yes, it's true. But that's us. We don't hold any of that against Yeti. We think that we made some poor management decisions.
Funny you should bring up Yeti and hair in your segue, gentlemen. Turns out a scientist wanted to get to the bottom of the whole Yeti story. Is the Yeti real? What's up with this Yeti? And finally, science has decided that let's tackle this. Let's look into the Yeti. He went and got hold of all the pieces of Yeti evidence he had that people would give to him, and hair particular, like, oh, these are some Yeti fragments, whatever. Got the stuff
Yeti
together.
They called it Yeti spaghetti. Come on, from now on, like, stop saying hair. We all know it's Yeti spaghetti.
No, he did not. That is a lie. That is a lie. Trying to cover up for the bad Yelp reviews you got. So he went and got the hair samples. He managed to get DNA from them and then went to this big, I think, GenBank, which is one of the big DNA databases, to find out, is this a real animal? Is this related to something?
Like, is this just monofilament wire and condensed chicken soup, or is it an actual creature?
One of the samples analyzed came from an alleged Yeti mummy in the Indian region of Ladakh at the western edge of the Himalayas and was taken by a French mountaineer who was shown the corpse 40 years ago. The other was a single hair found a decade ago in Bhutan, 800 miles to the east.
Now, this is different than most monster reportings are all stories, and there's very little physical evidence, especially like UFOs. You know, maybe somebody will have a blackout and or lost time, and then later they'll find a thing. Like, there was one dude who thought he had been chipped by aliens, but then they removed this cyst from him, and it turns out it was a piece of like blacktop. Like, the guy had ridden motorcycles and had, you know, taken a fall and had likely lodged it in. Yeah, on Mars.
What is different with this?
Chupacabras. Well, it's so often that the number one evidence is just the massive array of stories, and that's all you have. Like, the mere fact that there's not just one, but multiple pieces of you know, these are pieces of Yetis is tremendous.
Well, I mean, it's hair.
Yeah.
I mean, like, so what's the difference between Homeboy with his black top bump and this dude with some hair?
No,
like,
that's what I'm saying.
Incredible people on the planet. French Mountaineer. I don't know if that cracks the top 25. All of a sudden, it's shown.
Sorry.
Yes.
So, we have DNA from Yeti hair that we now go into the gen bank and try to look, can we find DNA related to some other animal? There is hair. There's actual hair. And yes, it's probably not monofilament. It's probably not new DuPont carpet. You're like, oh, what could this hair come from? If it came from a known animal, then it'd be like, all right, so what? If it came from an animal, but...
of unknown origin.
I got mine in my mentalist envelope, and I'm sealing it. I think I know.
Here, I'm gonna write mine down.
Go for it. Hop in there. What?
Yak. It's got to be yak hair, because it's all yaks up in the plains.
I got it, Brian. I don't want to ask you, but I'm going to nail it one shot. Are you ready?
What?
Bruce Valanche.
All right. That's who's right?
None of you.
Yeah.
It gets interesting. Have you ever heard of the idea of the Himalayas referred to as like a third pole?
No.
No.
If you look at a map, if you look at the world, if you look at a globe of the Earth, you see these bright white spot where Antarctica is, bright white spot where the Arctic is, and then you see in the Himalayas, tallest mountains in the world, you see this white spot there, and it looks in a way like it's a third ice cap. Okay? So Brian is going to...
it looks like I'll actually have to install Google Earth. Why not? I'll install Google Earth for this. Won't take but a second.
So it's described as a third pole in a sense. It's one way to look. If you came from outer space, you looked at Earth, you looked at there, you'd see like, man, there's a lot of ice there. You know, it's kind of an icy, cold place.
Well, and keep in mind, the Himalayas, part of the reason that they're so tall and spiky is that they're our youngest formation, right? Because they when India crashed into Asia, that's what that forced them all up. Whereas like something like the Appalachians in Eastern America used to be as tall as Himalayas. It's just the reason they're all rounded is because they've just been weathered down after so long.
I did not know that. That's fascinating.
Yeah. So the Appalachians are like old bitter granduncles to the Himalayas.
Yeah.
Oh, I see you running around with your Everests.
That's kind of cool. Like if you go to like up in Montana and you look in the mountains there and you see the ice flows, you can kind of see where like the glaciers sat on top of there and just sort of came over. And it's a very amazing visual to think about. You look at watch Game of Thrones in the wall, and then you go out into mountains where there's big tons of ice caps and stuff like that, and you start to see, man, glaciers were actually here. There was a point where you'd look, and there would be a wall of ice, just a continent worth of ice on there. And that remnants of part of that are still in the Himalayas. And so have you got a image yet? Or
yeah, it says it's in the very last. It counted down to 0 seconds, and now we're in the last few seconds of installing
getting down
Google
to the
Earth.
Wire, folks. So Brian's going to pull up an image just to sort of articulate this. And it certainly helps with context, I think, when you look at this, when I get to the reveal of what's going on here.
Yeah. Okay. So basically, if you were, you can start describing while this thing loads up here.
So the guy goes to, so GenBank is a collection of DNA samples from like every organism we can find. We put the DNA into this computer database. So then when you find something, you look for it. You might have a few segments or a few things. You try to find what's it similar to. And it's a great way. Now, it's a resource we didn't have before. It used to be you'd have a hair sample, and you would give it to, you know, some scientist would look at the hair and then try to figure out, well, it's kind of sort of like this, or it's got features of that. But it was a very imprecise way because you're just totally going on a visual thing. And we know that visually things can often be a little bit deceptive because you look at a timber wolf and the –
a marsupial wolf, which is separated by millions and millions of years. One's a marsupial, one's a canine, but they look very similar on a skeletal level.
Because they're both filling the same niche, right? Even though they got there by different paths, you need a certain size beast to do this type of thing in the ecosystem.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's what's kind of a curious thing. So that's the problem. So that's where genetics gives you a much more likely reason to believe that.
All right. So
if you type in third pole into Google, the first thing it comes up with is the Himalaya, and the idea that it's a third pole. So
and I'm looking by the way, if you open up Google Earth, there are only they don't show the ice because those aren't continents, but there are only three spots that are white. Antarctica, of course, covered in snow because all the photographs we have of that are covered in snow. Greenland, right up there near the North Pole, of course, all of that tends to be covered in snow. And then the only other spot that's always got the white on there here is Himalayas.
Yeah, you have the Tibetan Plateau, which is a big place. So third pole, if you ever look that up, it's just a fascinating way to think about things. So he does this DNA search, looks this up, and lo and behold, he gets a match. Now, again, this has not been verified yet. He's looking to have this independently verified to see if other people can see if this is true. He matched these hair samples to an ancient strain of polar bear.
What?
Whoa.
Hold on. Man, I just realized you did a whole you just tricked me right under my face. You're talking about the third pole and the creatures and marsupials and filling different niches. There's a version of polar bear.
This information is so mind. Thought I could facebook.com/don'ttrustandrewmain.
Yeah, man, I'm just sort of – this is really amazing. It's been a long time since I've played with Google Earth, but I'm just sort of –
So for audio listeners, Brian is scrolling around the Tibetan Plateau in Google Earth, and you just see this remote area ice. So there are bears that live in that region. And so the theory – and there's a lot – if you'd asked me what I would have thought it could have been, I would say maybe a species of bear. If there, I would think that there, I think there's enough stories of the Yeti, and you look at a lot of the Yeti iconography, and you're more likely to think if there is something that it would be an ursid, it'd be a bear instead of it'd be neat to find some sort of snow monkey there. But this is, it's promising, it's interesting. It's not conclusive. We, this data hasn't been independently verified, but the idea that there could be a breed of polar bear or bear living out there that blends in. It has those features that could be responsible for Yeti sightings. Is kind of awesome.
Here's what's exciting to me.
How old were the?
Go ahead, Justin.
How old were the corpses rumored to be?
So let me pull up the my weird file.
So while he's doing that, here's what's remarkable to me is maybe I'm a bit cynical, but. The moment I'm like, all right, you got something that might be a piece of Yeti fur, I'm just going to assume it's a yak because I just assume it's a fraud, right? But the idea, if this polar bear analog pans out, then that makes this not a fraud, but instead like a significant beast that is, that can do things that obviously no yak or whatever else you can see there can do. Bears are clever, man.
Well, the question would be whether or not it's still alive, and then it's, an extinct species. Does it still?
One sample was apparently 10 years old. The other one came from a corpse 40 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's.
I mean, if you trust French mountaineers.
So it's entirely it's interesting. We found some places in Vietnam and some other places where we found some large mammals. And if this is a thing that's sort of – if it is a bear, and you might have a lot of locals be like, oh, yeah, it's a bear, but just kind of a funny bear.
Silly bear.
It would be a – if it were a primate, people would be, hey, we don't know, but there are bears up there. But, hey, there's a species of bear in this remote area. That's plausible, and that we may have an abominable snowman after all, ladies and gentlemen.
That's awesome.
That's insane.
That is, I mean, and of course that's the holy grail of all your cryptids, right? Is when it makes the jump from being rumor and legend to known quantity. And I mean, on the one hand, you're kind of sad to see the mystery go away, but on the other hand, like, freaking new discovery, that's amazing.
Yeah, I think what's cool about this is that I'm going to get into a little bit later about, you know, how people who study cryptozoology and cryptids and et cetera can kind of proceed with this. But I think that if you have a rumor of a creature, and then it's one thing to say, oh, like, you know, chupacabras are often like mangy raccoons. And I think I've told you, I actually have seen a mangy raccoon, and I can understand where that comes from. Then you kind of go, well, it's a known species. But if it's an unknown species that fits this cryptid description, it's big. It's pretty awesome. It means that, you know, guess what? You know, this thing is, you know, legit.
It also is kind of sweet. Like, I don't know, in the internet age, I think a lot of us get jaded. Like, we've explored all the turf there is to explore. And I love that right here under our noses is another mystery that can blow our minds.
Speaking of blowing our minds.
Uh-oh. Yeah.
Thought something was dead.
What's it?
And even just the fact that we thought something was dead and then it didn't turn out to be dead.
Oh,
it turned
out
to live.
That's true. All right, but hold on. I heard a promise of blowing our minds.
Oh, I know. Do we have a commercial?
Oh. We're going to blow your mind with this sponsor message.
No. Not since last week when we had the same conversation.
Mind blown. Moving right along then. Facebook.com/don't trust Andrew Main.
Yeah, dude. This episode brought to you by the continuing success of Andrew Main. Go to Facebook.com/don't trust Andrew Main and be part of the maniacs.
We mentioned this last episode, and this is an exciting thing. It's a thing we've talked about before in Weird Things, because to me, it's like holy cow, this is kind of an awesome thing to think about. Scientists doing science in a scientific way with scientific tools have detected what they believe to be a rogue planet.
A rogue what? Plant?
Rogue planet.
Planet. Oh, yeah. I thought I saw this headline. A planet just floating out, no stars or nothing.
Nothing.
Just how
free as a ball.
How big it's being chased after by a giant space dog. How big does this planet need to be in order to be seen? Because
glad you asked that, Brian. First sentence of the article: a planet 6 times more massive than Jupiter has been spotted drifting cold and alone 80 light years from Earth.
That is remarkable that they were able to find it. Mainly because there are other supermassive Jupiters that we've seen orbiting other stars, but I guess this one did we find it by its heat signature? Because like, yeah.
So we've had the problem, because the problem is that we've had other bodies that are free floating, but they're hard to distinguish them between, like, as a failed star, like a brown dwarf. And so this is like, we're like, no, this the ignition did not take on or whatever, apparently. And it is it's exciting to think about this, because here's a model of space that we have right now that we need to get rid of. You know, we tend to think of it's like, you know, the model of, let's say, an electron, or excuse me, of an atom. You tend to think here's the protons and the neutrons in the center in the nucleus. Then you think of these electrons orbiting, you know, and then we think of like the solar system like that. You know, here's the sun, here are the 8.1 planets, right? And then way off, 3.5 light years away, whatever, is the next star. And that's how far away, it's just a bunch of emptiness in between. We're realizing that's not the case. You go from here, and then you get to the Pluto, and out in Pluto, you've got your Kuiper belt objects, which are some of these things that are close to Pluto size. And that's why we said we have to downgrade Pluto to a planet, from a planet to, you know,
to a dwarf planet.
Yeah, because we're finding there's a bunch of dwarf planets out there. And so the Kuiper belt goes on and on. Way out beyond there, you got the Oort cloud, where we've got comets and stuff. And there's a bunch of stuff out there free floating. So between here and the nearest star, there's going to be a lot of rocks. There's going to be a lot of things there that you know, asteroid-sized or bigger, Pluto-sized stuff out there that you could, when we start colonizing and move radiating outwards from our solar system,
it's not just like we have to go to the nearest star to find firm ground. We can go outside of our solar system or find things in these long orbits. Now, we're not going to find necessarily very massive things because we would probably pick them up from, like, you know, the orbits, how they would affect our planets and stuff, you know, like the planet 10. But we're going to find a ton of things, you know, Ceres, which is like, you know, the next biggest rock in our solar system that's not really like a dwarf planet. Well, Ceres, I guess, could be a dwarf
now, planet. From what we've talked about before, and I can't remember if it was you, Andrew, or you, Justin, but like, am I right? The question is, like, what's the point? But I guess the point is, like, all of that is tunnelable, safe places to be. Like we can move into those, you know, because your big problem being in space is you got things flying at you at high speeds that are very dangerous. You got cosmic radiation of all varieties coming at you and all stuff. But if you can get inside an asteroid or you know, I guess probably not getting inside this rogue planet, since it's a gas giant.
Ball of gas, but yeah.
But like, that is significant. Like, we need that real estate. Like, it matters that space isn't empty, right?
Yeah, why do we go to space? You know, we don't go to space just for the sake of it being space. You go there for resources. And the idea that there is tons of resources, you know, starting going from here on further on out, which whether it's balls of ice, balls of methane, whatever, nickel, iron, whatever, the things that you use to build things and to build civilizations on.
Right.
The future of human civilization, before we start colonizing planets outside our solar system, we're going to be living on rocks, living in things and environments that will seem a little bit different to us. But then think of how weird a shopping mall is to somebody, a Neolithic, just somebody from 10,000 years ago.
Yeah.
You know? And think about, you know, so the future of human civilization, I think my prediction is that we'll reach a point where, and I don't know if this is 100 years from now or whatever, but more people will live not on planets, but in space, in the space in between, on dwarf planets and other places, than will live on planets.
That's so bizarre to wrap my mind around. Mainly,
and you think about this as, like, you know, there might be Mars-sized objects and other things out there floating, free-floating, and you go, like, they're cold, but an object in the middle of space can still have geothermal activity. It can still have water. It can have liquid water. It can have a lot of these things we don't really even think possible. We just think of these dead rocks. But, you know, the center of our planet is got, you know, is this intense molten core that has, you know, basically a radioactive pile in a sense. And that can exist elsewhere outside of space. And so you can have resources. You can have energy. You can have a lot of things. These things could be habitable. And you want to talk about a beautiful, beautiful night, you know, view of the stars.
Yeah, you know, sure. Completely unobstructed. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's an exciting thing to think about. And if we never go faster than the speed of light, but the idea that if we start moving onto other worlds, that there's millions of islands. You know, I calculated the amount of living space there was. If you just took everything in the Oort cloud, took everything in the Kuiper belt and all of our asteroids without touching a single planet, and you wanted to turn them into inhabitable spheres that are cylinders, rather, you've got over a million Earths worth of material out there that you could reach in just a couple of years' time.
It's amazing. And I'll tell you what, like, you know, the first thing you think of is like, yeah, but, you know, you don't get pretty sunsets or whatever. All the things that we love about our planet, of course, we evolved to adore certain things about the environment that we're raised in here. I wonder how many of those will be transformed with, like, a virtualization, you know?
Yeah, I think absolutely. And I think that you might think of, there might be other things that you then do, you create or whatever, you know, and a sunset, you know, here for me in Burbank and Austin is a little bit different than sunset for somebody who lives above the Arctic Circle.
Right. Right.
You know, there are people who are perfectly happy living in places like that. I can't understand why, but,
but then again, you know, and also, and that's the flip side is when you go out and play on the surface of the asteroid with its light gravity, you know, it's the other thing is imagine putting on, you know, a 30th, 40th generation spacesuit where, you know, it feels comfortable and not bulky and you're able to bounce and play and frolic in space. I guess my guess is there's a trade-off there. That's pretty cool too.
Yeah. And you know, there was a book I read, which I really enjoyed its description of like how to do teleportation. And the idea was basically you would walk into this wall and it would kind of basically create a, it would put you in a sort of a suspended animation and then create a copy of you in another wall that you would walk out of.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of what telepresence can do in things like this, you know, in 50 years from now, we could be living a thing where you could live in your own planetoid or whatever dwarf planet series or asteroid with people who are a lot like you, but when you need to go to work on Earth, you know, you send Brian, virtual Brian, whatever, goes there, goes and does stuff, and then he comes back and uploads all that to you.
And I'll tell you, as the fidelity, I mean, we're closing in on understanding, you know, like we can now look at a human eye and see essentially how many pixels there are in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me in 100 years we could be at a place where you could get an exact one-to-one resolution visually of experience. And pretty soon we're at a point where, you know, where we could simulate, you know, stimulate nerves to get the feeling of actually being there. And we're already seeing a transformation. You know, 30 years ago, it was you could sneer and saying, you know, oh, these kids in their video games, why don't they just go out and play? Well, when you did go out and play, you did two things. You picked fights and you jumped from rock to rock. And nowadays, you know, what do you do in video games? You pick fights and you jump from rock to rock.
Yeah.
And nowadays, when you see programs like The Guild that take seriously the friendships that are forged by people in virtual space and the virtual adventures that they're having, there's a legitimacy to that experience that I think is only going to get better. And you know, very soon it won't matter physically where your body is.
And I think two things are happening simultaneously. One makes a leap, the other catch up. One is our ability to create virtual spaces that resemble real worlds. And then the other thing is our ability to manipulate the real world to represent virtual spaces. And you reach this point where the two connect, and the idea that there being a difference to them is sort of silly or irrelevant, you know, difference between, you know, living in a house or living outside.
And it's a very intentional decision. You know, for example, you know, the desire to make real war more like a video game. You know, you see with the addition of heads up displays and you know, always on communication and biological systems monitoring, I think is an example of exactly what you're talking about, where it's like that gets closer to the virtual space as the virtual space gets closer to reality.
Imagine describing what we're doing right now to somebody 2,000 years ago, or maybe even 500 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. It would be sorcery. You conjure up a ghost iteration of everyone, and we all meet in an ethereal astral plane, and the record of our meeting is sent essentially telepathically to thousands of people all over the world.
And it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
And it's a thing done a million times every day, to the point that we, you know, the idea of trying to explain the idea of this, that we get caught up in trying to explain the technology, but like you just said, the concept of what we're doing, like, we are in three different parts of the country right now. We're communicating visually, creating a, you know, program with other people watching and doing this sort of stuff. We very much feel we can piss each other off emotionally very, very quickly. We can make each other laugh. We can do all of these things in real time, spread across the world with an audience watching and participating. And, you know, the future is going to be in a more intense version of this.
Yeah. Well, and I think about this all the time, and it's like, you know, it's very popular, and maybe it's getting less popular. Is it just me, or are you noticing fewer people talking about how everything's getting worse? Because growing up, that's all I heard about. Pollution's worse. You know, the threat of global thermonuclear war is worse. You know, tensions are worse. You know, is worse. Traffic's worse.
Is kind of the great gift of our prosperity. Like, that's what we do. We are well enough. We live long enough. We can communicate freely enough so we can talk about how we suck.
Yeah.
But Brian says, is it are fewer people? I think that we certainly are able to tune out some of it. And I think that, you know, the gloom and doom sort of things we tend to put into perspective now because we've heard enough of that. And we know that there are real things. And you know, we worry about, should I recycle my cans? And then a goddamn meteor hits Russia, and we're like in disbelief, going, "Was this real?" And they're like, "No, it's real. This is like, well, we're worrying about little things like that. We're part of a big universe that doesn't really care for us one way or the other."
Well, and I don't know. It's I feel like, you know, the whole reason like we want to think of something that we could do right now. And that's why, you know, recycling cans feels really good, because you project a problem and you're like, well, now I'm doing a thing, and therefore now I don't have to feel so bad about that problem. But I feel like in general, this is what's amazing, is as psychology increasingly becomes a hard science. That's another thing that's changed just in the last 20 or 30 years. Psychology from being this sort of like this fringy meta science where it's like you can't really test a lot of X, Y, and Z. So, you know, physicists might roll their eyes at them. As we zero in on large scale studies of a behavior of the internet, and we see all the different ways that our wetware is flawed and these weird constructs that we have to compensate for them, you know, like you know, that we figured out, like, we think we used to talk about the madness of crowds, now we talk about the wisdom of crowds. That is very exciting to me, to see how we could take advantage of our weird biological impulses and leverage them for something that we understand would be better for everyone in the long term.
And still, the thing that frustrates me is, like, I was somewhere and I threw a can away, and somebody goes, "You need to recycle that." And I said, "Listen, if we were running out of aluminum and it was really rare, I wouldn't want to throw it away, would I? Because it would be a lot more expensive." You know, and it was this, wait. I said, "Yeah, if, you know, recycle bottles, why? Why am I recycling this? Why did they sell it to me for so cheap?" It's because we have an abundance of glass. It's actually wasteful and more expensive to haul that glass away to some recycling facility. But it's this religious thing. I'm not like, okay, there are some places where it's different. Lived in Japan, they had to import everything. It was made more sense to bring that in. And, you know, people talk about landfills. Like, yeah, who likes to tell you how expensive landfills are and how we're running out? People who own landfills.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, there's at one point, I forgot how we got there, but I was talking with Chad Johnson 3 or 4 years ago, and I was like, man, I just wish, you know, part of the problem with recycling is that we don't know. There are certain things that are rare now, but it'll be abundant later. I wish what we could do is, instead of trying to recycle stuff that's already common, like, we could just take all of our material and, like, have, like, a vault to store it in until market conditions reach a point where it's profitable to grab it back out. And then, you know, of course, realizing that I'm exactly describing a landfill.
Yeah. It's like we get, like, oh, these iPhone recycling, whatever. We took every iPhone that was ever made and stacked them end to end and anything. You're going to maybe take up a large Apple store.
Wait, say that again?
If you took every single iPhone ever made and stacked them, like, three-dimensionally in volume, you'll fill up maybe one large Apple store with iPhones.
Whoa, brain explosion. That's crazy. I didn't even think about that. Yeah, all right. Well, then that solves that problem. Next issue.
Yeah. You know, so anyhow, I mean, that's just it. It's and you can say, like, well, when it gets anyhow, it, wow. We want to worry about it. Again, recycle, dispose your things in a green way. That's absolutely fine.
Did we already talk about this? There is something I wanted to bring up. And it has to do with junk and trash and recycling and stuff floating in space. Did we already talk about gravity on this podcast, or am I thinking?
I have not seen it yet, and so
okay. There is the aspect I wanted to talk about. You can talk with. I don't think it's a spoiler, since it's, you know, the entire conceit of the show.
It's in space?
Yeah. In gravity, you know, of course, the story is the space junk hits, trashes the shuttle. There's a cascade of space junk, right? Now, the story is all about, you know, an individual person, and it's very emotional. It's about the human side of that one person's adventure. However, that's not what is amazing to me about it, is that they can make that the focus of the show, leaving out what is a colossal disaster movie. The idea that an unfortunately placed missile blowing up, one satellite hits another satellite, hits another satellite. Now you've hit the station, space stations, and now and just everything, like ping, you know, with the experiment with ping pong balls and the mouse traps, you know, where it's a chain reaction. That's a world in which all of space is ruined for a decade to come, and telecommunications is sent rocketing back to the 1970s. where it's all direct landlines. I found myself kind of stuck in thinking, what would that world look like? And I wanted to get Andrew's thoughts on it. And yes, I know that you know, they took some liberties and there's different orbits, and realistically, it's unlikely that you could trash everything all at once. But within the world that they created, this idea where low Earth orbit is nothing but trash and it's inherently unsafe to put anything up there, what would happen to society in that world?
I didn't know that was a world they were building.
They say right at the beginning. That's the whole thing. They say in the first 5 minutes. They're like, we have debris, probably nothing. Oh wait, debris started a chain reaction. It's coming at you, everything. And then
I didn't see that, but it's okay. It's
literally the first 5 minutes. You'll see it when you see it. And I don't think I'm ruining it.
Yeah, but it was in gravity. Is it just the satellites that they are using for the?
Can we not talk about plot elements of the movie?
Literally
I'm just asking, baby. I'll answer Brian's question, but let's not get into the full what happened there.
Yeah, sorry. I know. I'm still trying to save it for you.
I really want to see it. I've been trying really hard to see it, and it's not like, man, don't spoil it for me. I know.
And it's getting harder, and like the window's closing. That's why we went in the middle of a day, and because no, I was like,
I've had like 2 days where I thought I'm gonna go see it, and then it's like I got called and go do stuff, and I'm like, all right. And then I'm thinking, I really was. As to that, we have not made an effort to actively try to like clean up debris or whatever like that. We design our satellites and stuff with the idea they're going to be in these sort of pristine vacuums, and then now we get to the idea there are little paint chips and things like that that can make it problematic. As to that, I don't think it's an insurmountable problem at all. When you say, okay, you have to deal with this is the thing you have to deal with, and then you build. You spend more money armoring these things. Remember, putting stuff up now is still expensive. And so putting 100 pounds of armor or Kevlar or whatever on something to protect it, or designing electronics so that if a high-speed bullet goes through it, that it can rebuild itself and have redundancies, is not a thing we do right now outside of perhaps military satellites. Mm-hmm. We know the military has been thinking heavily about this problem because they're dealing with the idea of, you know, what happens when, you know, you start using... You know, other countries want to take out your satellites, and other countries have been actively working to do that. And that's one of the big things. That's one of the reasons why we still don't have high levels of cooperation between other countries when it comes to certain technologies, because we know people from other countries are actively trying to find ways to incapacitate what we have. And it's frustrating because I'll talk with friends who are scientists like, oh, it's just science. I'm like, yeah, but this bit of information is very useful to this other country, and the reason this person's here is because they want that. But anyhow, I think it's problematic, but I don't think it puts us back to landlines at all. I think it just means that, you know, it makes things more expensive. But these are solvable problems.
How long, right now, how many satellites do we have? How many artificial satellites are in orbit? There we go. Man, I love the fact that Google just reads your mind now and you just start to say it, and it's like, yeah, I get it. Here we go. I'm looking at a quick YouTube video breaking down all of the items on there. Nope, it doesn't have whatever. I thought it was like 20,000. Is that right? Or here we go.
The United States Space Surveillance Network tracks roughly 8,000 objects currently in orbit.
Yeah, okay. 8,300, about 3,000 are not operational, having lived out their useful life and are part of space debris.
The stuff that gets scary is that there's the ones we track and we tell people to move orbits. It's the thing, it's the paint chips. It's the bolts. It's the little thing. Like, we'll keep track of a wrench or something like that. And we know what we did, and the Russians hopefully keep track of it. But it's the fragments and stuff make it scary. And the problem is that it's these things are going around 22,000 miles an hour, just whizzing around. And so one little thing effectively makes this deadly ring everywhere it goes. And if you're traveling across it or moving or whatever, and you get a lot of stuff. So I don't mean to downplay the problem it is. I'm just saying that once we say, if this did become a problem, we would have it's a culpable problem. It's a solvable problem.
So on that subject, I was I seem to remember when I was a kid, I forget which magazine, some science magazine, but they had suggested, and this is back in the 80s, that to clear out space debris, you could do something like send up a rocket that essentially does a mixture and creates like a 3 mile wide block of foam that's only purpose is to make a few laps around the Earth, let whatever debris is there run into it and hit it, which slows it down just enough that eventually the foam falls down to planet Earth. And there was something so audacious and big about that that sounded cool to me.
Yeah, I think, yeah, absolutely. I think that's the, you know, getting into, you know, cleaning up, and it's going to be, you know, kind of go, well, who's going to, you know, who's going to pay for it? Well, whoever benefits the most by making sure that stuff's not up there. And that's the end of the day is that, you know, if you know you need an orbital path or need an area swath or something like that, then, you know, we figure out, again, these are inevitable problems, but they're solvable problems. They're just sort of weird for us to think about at first, but, you know, and that's all the more reason why we want a really cheap, rapidly reusable form of space travel getting up into low Earth orbit.
I guess that's the thing. The moment you started to comment on it, it hit me that that while in that moment, you know, we're you know, if all the satellites, just everything turned to junk, that doesn't take away our the massive increases in our ability to get up to space affordably. And of course, as we've talked about on this podcast, you know, SpaceX is going to transform all of that for us.
Yeah, likely. And you've got Jeff Bezos of Amazon working really hard with you know, Blue Origin, which, you know, Elon Musk says, you know, he said, I'd sooner think we'll see a unicorn underneath the rocket pad in the launch blast than Bezos will get something into space.
Whoa! This is a side of Musk I haven't seen.
I think that he's encouraged Bezos before, and he welcomes it, but I think that he's kind of like saying, you guys need to throw a lot more resources and energy into this problem.
Huh. Right on, man.
Yeah. So
you guys want to
I look at it as a challenge thrown down by Musk. I'm like, Musk, I think he would love to see, you know, Blue Origin come up with, you know, a really good, I think that it's a, you certainly want to be the biggest guy on the block, but also once you start to build, when there's only one, when IBM was the only guy, only company.
Uh-oh, Skype lag. When IBM was the only company that that was doing mainframes, I assume?
Yeah, when IBM was the only real company that was actually building computers, you know, there was a narrow market for it. And then when the PC exploded, then all of a sudden, boom.
Yeah. Hey, man, I'm coming up. I'm like 10, 15 minutes from my heart out. You guys want to do some picks?
I got a pick.
Go for it.
So we're talking about creatures like abominable snowmen and et cetera. And you're like, you know, Andrew, I would like to read more on the origins of this stuff and the history of this. And, you know, where does this come from the point of view of people who are fascinated by cryptozoology and cryptids, et cetera. And I have the book for you.
It is Abominable Science. Oh, that's Daniel Loxton's new book.
Our pal Daniel Loxton has a new book called Abominable Science. On the cover is a Yeti. Now, Daniel's a guy to watch, to follow, because as we get more information about this bear DNA and if it's legit or not, he'll be probably one of the first people to cover it. And this is a fascinating book Daniel Loxton wrote with Donald Prothero. And it gets into the history and the origins of all this stuff. And, you know, it's Daniel has done a fantastic job working with Skeptic Magazine and Skeptic Junior. He's an amazing artist, amazing storyteller. We get into what's the real science of, you know, cryptozoology, science or pseudoscience. He gets into Bigfoot, Yeti, Nessie, the evolution of the sea serpent, the Mowgli Mowgli, and just it is extremely well documented and well searched. And the visuals in this book are fantastic.
I'll tell you what, man, his art skills are no joke. If you've seen, you know, he's done children's books like Pterosaur Trouble and Ankylosaur Attack, where he'll take all these references and compile them and throw in some amazing 3D work that looks just great. I'm a really big fan of everything that Daniel's done.
Here's a nice picture of Nessie with a little fishing lure in her mouth. Daniel's work. This is just an extremely. I've only managed to just dip into a little bit of this book, but it is it's an amazing work. I recommend it to everybody out there. It's beautiful. It gets into, you know, what's the story about these dinosaurs out there in Africa, and what's the story about this. And this is Daniel is an extremely passionate guy about this, you know, and so he co-wrote this with Donald Prothero, who is an active scientist in paleontology, and so he's actually a professor of geology at Occidental College, and so it's got just a wonderful expertise going into it. There's a passion for the subject that Daniel has that I love, and Daniel's, you know, a skeptic in the sense that, you know, we need information, but he's a guy that's actively going out there to go look at the information, seek out what's being said there, and the visuals in here are fantastic, and just the amount of just rich details in here is amazing. I think he's probably written the definitive book right now on the subject, and I am it's every page is filled with something exciting. You know, a dragon from the Gate of Ishtar of it. Maybe you can see that.
Oh, yep. Unfortunately, I don't have a separate camera worked out for you, but yeah, you can see it right there.
Just getting into like what's the roots of these things? Why do we choose to believe in these things? And where do they come from? So that's my pick. The book again is Abominable Science. Right, it's got the cover's fantastic. Cover's amazing. It's got some wonderful quotes by Michael Shermer, Niles Eldridge, etc. I highly recommend it. He's got a lot of wonderful academic, you know, credits to it, but he writes for the rest of us. He writes for the people who want to pick up a book that looks like a pulp science fiction novel.
Yeah,
you know, with the Yeti screaming in the wind.
So, I got to pick. Justin, do you have something?
I don't know how much you guys.
Uh-oh, that's really weird.
Out, and I'm only hearing like every two words that you guys say, but Gravity, it's good. Go see it.
Right on. Yeah, what's funny is even as you said that, Justin, we had a weird Skype hiccup, but we got that your pick was Gravity for sure.
The satellites are falling apart. I was wrong.
So I got a quirky pick for you. It's a PC game that was developed, I want to say, 7 years ago. By a small team in Russia. It was a low-budget title. It was a turn-based. Lately, I've been into games that I can just step up and walk away from and come back and resume. This is a turn-based universe in which an alien threat called the Dominators is coming in. And this game...
Do they wear leather pants, Brian?
Yes. In this game, it's turn-based, and you are a space ranger, and your job is eventually to get powerful enough for you to start taking on this massive threat to the galaxy face-to-face. But in order to get there, you got to make money. And how you make money is kind of up to you. Do you want to be a space pirate? You could trade. You could buy materials at a low price in one-star systems and raise them at another. You could do, and they also have all these special quests. And what gets me is the variety of these special quests. Some of them are deliver this MacGuffin to this star system by this date. Some of them, like you land.
The MacGuffin market.
Yes, exactly. Some of them you land and all of a sudden it's a real-time strategy game. You're playing a miniature version of StarCraft where you have to build a bunch of robots and defeat the other guy's robots. Some of them you land, and they are these ridiculous, outrageous text adventures. You remember the days of Zork back in on the Apple IIe in the 1980s?
I love that. That's what got me into programming was going, I could write a thing where I ask you a question, yes or no, and I could write a story that was this interactive stuff. I absolutely love that stuff.
So
Space Quest was my favorite.
Oh yeah, exactly. The Sierra Online games. In this case, like, and they're just kind of, the whole thing's tongue in cheek. Like, there's one time you land and you need to become president. So it's this whole mini game where it's like you have 30 days until the election, and every morning you could consult with different advisors and you decide whether to spend more money on your ad campaign or smearing the other guy. You've got you got some bits where you have to win a fishing tournament in one, and so you had to buy the right kind of reel and match the right type of worm for the right kind of fish in order to get more than the other guy. There's one where you go to show up to help some stranded scientists, and you immediately get bit by some toxic thing, and you only have 24 hours to go find its mate to remove the poison gland, to find the antidote or whatever. It's all over the map, and it's ridiculous, and I love it. And the whole time, the whole game is randomly generated. All of the star systems are randomly generated. All of the loot that you can buy is randomly generated. So you find yourself, you know, shopping, trying to earn money so you could buy an upgraded, engine rig or whatever. The reason it's relevant now, 7 years after they made it, is they just this month released an HD kind of rebooted version of it. So it's called Space Rangers HD. Was it a something war, like a far away, a war apart, I think is what it is, but it's available on Steam right now. It's only $19.99. So less than $20. And it's like, I'm so sucked back into this world. It's really great.
Fishing.
It's like, it doesn't matter. The whole thing is like, yeah, you got to go to a place and get a thing.
Justin, are you there?
Yeah, I don't know if you guys can hear me.
Yeah, we can.
Do you have a pick?
Yeah, he says gravity.
Just gravity? Just go it? All right. There you go. I think that's about it on the weird things.
That's all the things that are weird in the world in only 70 minutes.
So, everybody, thank you very much for your watching, listening, and participating. And we're going to try to be back next week with more weird things. Till then... Justin, Brian, and myself.
Say it.
This has been strange.
No. It's your tagline. You got to say it. It's how you always wrap
it up. It's unusual.
It almost.
Odd.
Okay. Man, I'm starting to think I can't trust you with this.
It's winsome.
It's been winsome.
It's been weird. That I can't remember what I'm supposed to say.
It is weird. You'd think since you created the show and the network.